We've come to the end of this period, this day of silence, of sitting and walking. And I feel a number of, it's kind of a heartfelt feeling for me to kind of come to the end of the day like this. A lot of different feelings. Some of them from having met with some of you and talked to some of you about your practice. And some of it just sitting here. I feel, it's one of the things I feel is a lot of gratitude that we do such things. We come together and we offer this kind of day to each other. And it's really something we create together, all of us who come together. And I sat with you as you sat with each other and you sat with me. And it was very, very sweet. It felt pretty quiet and settled and silent today. I was surprised. I didn't expect it to be as quiet as it was. And it just felt very nice. I feel very grateful that we do such a thing. And you know, it's a very simple thing that we do when we do mindfulness practice in a day like today. Sometimes the instructions might sound complicated, or sometimes we make it complicated by all our struggles inside. But it's actually an incredibly simple thing. It's simply to be awake to what's happening in the present moment. Being awake is really the operating word. We're really awake. We're really present for the feelings of our breath, the sensations of our breathing, or the sounds in the room, or the sounds around us, or the light, the lighting that goes on, or the steps of our feet as we walk. It can be remarkably simple. It's as simple as feeling the sensation of the next step. There's nothing we have to figure out or attain or get to, or some great thing is going to happen if we do it just right. All of us know what the sensation is of our feet touching the ground, and it's that simple. You hear the sound of my voice. There's nothing, you don't have to necessarily understand what I'm saying. You don't have to figure, you know, make sense out of it. It's the very simple act of perception that hears the sound of a voice that's speaking in a big, big room like this. It's that simple as registering and receiving that sound. So it's very simple in a sense, the practice. It's not so easy to do, that simplicity, but it's very simple. And I think it's important to stress the simplicity of it. And the way that I understand the teachings of the Buddha, he was constantly, in his way, he didn't use the word simple that often, but in his way, stressing the simplicity of, he was stressing a very, very simple message. And he was stressing a very simple practice. And sometimes it's very easy for us to miss the simplicity of what the Buddha was teaching. I met a monk when I was in Thailand. He was a relatively young monk, but he was maybe 20 or 21, but he'd been in robes. He'd been a novice and been a monk for about 10 years. He was ordained as a novice, I think, when he was 10 or 11. And so he spent all these years as a monastic. So I asked him, what have you attained out of all your years of practice? And I asked him that because there was something special quality about him, that being at peace or some calm or something that I valued there. So I asked him, you know, what is it you attained? And his answer surprised me. He said, the main thing I've attained so far in my practice is non-contentiousness. And I thought that was, you know, why was that kind of special? You know, I thought that was kind of an odd answer. But I thought that was actually a pretty good answer. It's a pretty good attainment to be non-contentious. And so we practice to become non-contentious people, perhaps. But one of the things that they were practicing, and one of the things the Buddha was teaching, was how not to be in conflict with ourselves and with the world. To be and no longer be in conflict. And I like that because I like saying it that way. The goal of the practice is to be without conflict. I prefer saying it that way than to say it, the goal of the practice is to be at peace. And many people, some people think that the goal of practice is to be at peace, or they want peace as the goal, or they think the Buddha was talking about some great peace. And the danger with that is that then we reify peace. We think peace is some particular thing, some particular state of being, some particular emotional way of being in the world. But when we say the goal is to not be in conflict, that actually creates some openness, some open possibility that for anything, for a lot of things, once you're not in conflict, it's like, it's, you know, once you're peaceful, then you have to hold on to the peace. But once you have no conflict, you're full of possibility. And we don't know what's going to fill that space. And actually probably the whole realm, a range of ways we can respond and live in the world can come into that. So not to be in conflict. And most of us, I think if we study ourselves, if we're mindful of our suffering, most of us will find that our suffering arises out of conflict. We're in conflict with something. We're in conflict with ourselves. We're in conflict with the world around us. How we are is not the right way of being. So we're in conflict with that. We think we have to be different. What's happening in the present moment is not the right thing that's supposed to be happening. So we're in conflict with that. The conflict takes many forms. Either it takes the form of judgment, takes the form of aversion, of resistance. It takes the form of fantasizing or dreaming or demanding or something to be different. Some form of compulsion often comes into place. And Buddhist practice is designed to end compulsion, to end compulsive conflict. Not to be in conflict anymore. And not to be in conflict doesn't mean that we don't say no. We can still say no to the world, to things. Someone comes and asks us for something and demands something of us, and we say no. One of the... I don't know what to say. Maybe just if you take this a little bit as a joke, that's only half serious. One of the great tragedies of American Buddhism is the number of meetings we have to go to. Those of us who are teachers are kind of... I've always found meetings to be very difficult. And just so many meetings, my God. And one of the things, you know, you might ask, why do you have to go to meetings? So simple, isn't it? Anyway, for whatever reason, we go to meetings a lot. I go to a lot of meetings. And one of the things I discovered that made it a lot easier for me to go to meetings is that generally the meetings I go to, the general sense of it is that everybody has to kind of agree before something's decided. It took me a long time to understand the implications of that. But one of the implications of that was that I didn't have to be in conflict with anyone. I didn't have to rush in with my opinion. I didn't have to kind of make sure that I was heard. I didn't have to make sure that I was, you know, I rush in and explain, you know, my point of view or whatever, or criticize someone else for their point of view. I could just wait and not say anything. Because when it finally came to make a decision, I could say no. And then, oh, that's interesting. Gil says no. Why are you saying no? And then they're interested. And then I tell them. But I didn't have to, rush in with my opinion and kind of, you know, immediately get into a fight about my opinion or my way of seeing things. I could not be in conflict and just kind of wait. And sooner or later, there was a chance to kind of say, you know, no, I don't agree. But I didn't have to do that with a sense of conflict or being in... And I found that tremendously liberating for me in these meetings. The meetings, maybe I was very lucky to be in a context where people are respectful of each other. So that was, you know, I wasn't steamrolled over when I said no. But to learn to say no was one of the things I had to learn when I lived in Buddhist monasteries. Any kind of institution kind of has a way of always asking more of us. More and more and more. You can never do enough for an institution. I don't know if you've noticed that. So I had to learn to say no. But you can say no without being in conflict. So to be non-conflicted doesn't mean we don't say no. So not to be in conflict with ourselves, not to be in conflict with the world, is kind of, in some sense, the goal of the practice. In order to do that, it's necessary to trust ourselves very deeply, to be able to trust ourselves in some way. And I think part of the process of mindfulness is learning to know ourselves well enough so that we can trust ourselves. And trust really comes with knowing ourselves. That's the way trust is discovered. And that's why mindfulness is such a powerful practice. And if we don't trust ourselves, it's very hard to discover this possibility of living life without conflict, living a life that's at ease. So, at some point, in his teaching career, the Buddha gave the famous discourse to the Kalamas. And this is his discourse on how to trust ourselves, and more specifically, what we can trust when we trust ourselves. Because the Kalamas came to the Buddha and said that basically there's a lot of different teachers that come through here. You know, if you go to East-West Books in Mountain View and you just kind of stay there, you know, for a few weeks just listening to all the teachers that come through, there's a lot of different teachings that go on. And one of the reasonable questions to ask when you hear a lot of different spiritual teachings and all kinds of different ways to live your life and different kind of goals and different kind of purposes of life is to ask, which of these different teachers, which of these venerable priests and contemplatives are speaking the truth, and which ones are lying? It's pretty good, I thought. They're kind of, these wonderful Kalamas come to the Buddha and they say, we hear all these different teachers, how do we know who's true and who's lying? That's a pretty reasonable question, I think. Get to the point. The Buddha's response is, of course you are uncertain. Of course you are in doubt. When there are reasons for doubt, uncertainty is born. So I like that, because the Buddha says, it's okay that you feel doubt. It's okay that you feel uncertainty. Doubt is a fine thing to feel when there's cause for uncertainty. And when all these different people parade through and give their teachings, and you're uncertain about what's going on, it's reasonable to have doubt. You should have doubt. In this case, meaning if you can't decide among all these different teachers who is lying and who is true, the Buddha actually is not going to answer them directly. He's not going to tell them who's lying and who's telling the truth. That's the first interesting thing. He's not going to be contentious. He's not going to state his opinion about this. He'll let them be as they are. But he says, in this case, in the case that you can't decide who is lying, who's telling the truth, in that case, then don't go by reports. Don't decide. Don't decide where it's true or false. By reports, by analogies, by agreement with your views, by probability, by inference, by analogies, by agreement with your views, I'm repeating myself, or by thought, or because this particular teacher is my teacher, and therefore it must be true. Don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, and by the thought, this teacher is my teacher, therefore it's true. I hope you followed that. Because this particular list of things you shouldn't rely on is what most people rely on in their life. We rely on, some traditions rely on scripture. The scripture is true, therefore it must be true. Some people rely on the fact that the teacher says so. Very nice, if I could just say whatever I want and you believe me. It'd be very efficient. But it would be disastrous. I don't want you to believe me just because I say so. We agree with things because it agrees with our views. And this is actually extremely common in life, that we have certain views and certain preferences, certain ways we think it should be because it's nice that way. And then we agree with whatever it is that bolsters and supports our particular opinion. And so our opinions change over time, and so then the people we kind of hang out with changes because we want to hang out with people who agree with our opinion. By inference or by intuition, many of us rely on our intuitive sense of what is right and wrong. And I think it's very challenging to us that the Buddha says, don't go by inference, don't go by intuition. Because many of us, that's what really we rely on, some intuitive sense of knowing. And the Buddha says, actually, maybe that's not really reliable, our intuitive sense. In one place in the scriptures, the Buddha actually also criticizes relying too quickly on what we can know from meditation. Some people say, well, the meditative knowing, what we can really learn from meditation, that's really teaches us what is true and what is false. And the Buddha said, you know, actually that's not even necessarily the case either. Sometimes this particular list in English is translated as by our reasoning. Here it says logical conjecture. And here in the West, we put a tremendous amount of value on our reasoning, and that we can reason our way to the truth. And the Buddha actually says, is actually kind of skeptical about that. He actually suggests, don't do that way. So it's a little bit of a funny thing here. Because here the Buddha is saying, don't go by all these things. And who is he to tell us? You know, he's just another one of these teachers coming through. And he says, in the end of it, says, don't say because a teacher says so. But here he's a teacher telling you what you should do and shouldn't do. So it's kind of tricky. It's kind of like a Mobius strip. You can't get out of the trap. But I think it's very, very interesting that the Buddha says this. Don't go by the fact that it's traditional to believe this. It's been my tradition, my family's tradition, my religious tradition for generations and generations. It must be true because it's traditional. The Buddha says, don't rely on that because traditions aren't necessarily true either. Our reasoning isn't necessarily truthful. What I find when people come to a tradition like Buddhism, Buddhist practice, here in the West, and kind of here in Palo Alto, California, is that many people have an interest in things spiritual. And they're looking around for some kind of spiritual practice. And Buddhism somehow fits into the subcategory of spiritual practices, and so they're interested in that also. But spirituality is a very vague word, the word spiritual. I actually went through this week and looked through all the different books I could find on Vipassana practice in English to see how much the teachers use the word spiritual. It was very revealing. Some teachers used it a lot and some teachers didn't use it at all. But one of the interesting trends was that in these books in English, 20 years ago, the word was never used. And slowly through time, the word's getting used more and more. Even by the teachers who 20 years ago didn't use it at all, are now using it more. So this word spiritual is used a lot, but it's very vague what it means. And different traditions have different references for what it means. And for some people it means to really find the true self. For some people it means to find our true connection with the universe, or with the essence of the universe. For some people what's spiritual is that which... Well, let me ask you, what are the definitions of what spirituality is? Some of the definitions you've heard, if you don't want to admit to your own. How is the word spirituality defined? Or what does it mean? What are things that are included in it? Yes?
To be in awe of something greater than yourself.
Spirituality is to be in awe of something greater than yourself. And so that's a common one. The one to have some relationship to something that's larger than oneself. To surrender the small self for this thing that's larger than ourselves, as some people say. But awe, okay.
Not things that can't be understood with the logical mind.
So spirituality, so those things which can't be understood with the logical mind belong to the world of spirituality. Okay? So used to be a lot more things were spiritual than they are now, because we understand more things than we used to. What else? Maybe, yes?
Some people use it as sort of the search for meaning.
The search for the meaning of life. Good, okay. So the philosophical quest for meaning is sometimes a spiritual quest for some people. Okay? What else have you heard? What are some of the ideas from your friends, maybe, what they think spirituality is? How about the traditional meaning of it? Spirit. It has to do with that which has to do with the spirit. the spiritual, does that have to do with, you know, back 100 years ago, the word spirituality, I think, mostly referred to spiritualists who, you know, connected to the spiritual world through channeling or through whatever way they had. And that sense of spirituality isn't so strong in our particular circles, but you still find in some parts of our country, of our culture, that spirituality primarily means like channeling or connecting to spiritual beings of all kinds. Having a spiritual connection to God is a spiritual thing. So this is not generating a lot of examples here. You guys are, maybe it's the end of a day, and that's okay, but yes?
People often say, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious.
Oh, that's common.
Yeah.
So it's often used as a contrast with being part of some institution, some religious institution. I feel certain things, but I don't play
In that sense, sometimes spirituality is considered to be very personal. Spirituality is something that you personal experience, your personal feeling that the person might have.
Yeah, for me, I guess spirituality encompasses more of the bad as well as the good than religion does. To me, religion is like this institution where you're working towards that, or spirituality is just kind of what you are in essence, but not really having anything to do with bad and good. It just encompasses
everything. Okay, so it's an all-encompassing sense of who we are, good and bad. This is your definition of spirituality. What I'm trying to get at, which hopefully it's a reasonable thing to do, is try to point out that the word spiritual has many different references and meanings in our culture. And if two people are talking about using the word spiritual, they don't necessarily talking about the same thing, even though they're both nodding their heads. They think they're talking about the same thing, but they could be talking. One person can be talking about the spiritual being, you know, that person. They met someone who was really spiritual. Oh, I'd like to meet that person. You know, and that person could be in great awe of the mystery, or that person simply means that person has, is really accepted their dark and their light sides, which are maybe two different things. Or that person means they have a very direct connection with some spiritual being, some disembodied spirit, and that's what makes them spiritual. There's many things that the word spiritual can refer to. If you're following me, and basically kind of, you don't have to agree with me, but anyway, if you're following me, what I'm trying to say, when people come to Buddhist practice, they bring with them a lot of their understanding. If they want Buddhism to be their spiritual practice, they bring with them a lot of their ideas of what spirituality is, and they want Buddhism to do the same, to meet that, to satisfy that. And so they bring a lot of ideas, a lot of complicated ideas, a lot of baggage to their understanding of Buddhist practice. They want it to be a spiritual practice. And perhaps Buddhism is not a spiritual practice at all. And I say that as a challenge to you, because many of us want it to be a spiritual practice. Maybe it's not a spiritual practice. Then you ask, well, what is it? I'm not going to let it be a religious practice, that's for sure. So, no way. You know, so what is it? Well, some people say it's a way of life. But what does that mean? It doesn't say much at all. Some people say, well, it's a philosophy. Most of us aren't interested in philosophies per se. You know, you can go to Stanford and study philosophy, it doesn't help your life much. Some people want to call it a therapy. But you know, there's a lot of Buddhists who get kind of uncomfortable reducing it just to the idea of a therapy. You know, it's therapy, that's all. So what is it? We want it to be something. Well, maybe we don't have to make it anything. We can be in awe of what it is. Buddhist practice doesn't be anything. But, so the Buddha went on, talking to the Kalamas, said, don't go by all these things, by tradition, by inference, by reports, by inference, by intuition, by reasoning. Now, this is all fine for spiritual teachings. But what's interesting also to me is a lot of the suffering live under, it comes from having taken something, some belief as being authoritatively true. So, for example, the belief that I am unworthy. We believe it. On what authority do we believe it? On tradition, on reports, on heresy, on intuition, on reasoning, because someone has told us that. Like for when I was told in eighth grade that I had no artistic ability. And I went for the next 10 years of my life believing that. That's the way the world was made up. It was only because of the authority of my eighth grade art teacher who told me that. Can you believe someone telling you that in eighth grade? So I went with that authority. We pick up a lot of things from our environment, from our culture, from our experiences in life, and we reason on that. We base some conclusions about ourselves based on that. We never ask, on what authority is this true? On what authority is it true that it's wrong for me to feel depressed? On what authority do I take it that I believe that it's wrong or bad for me to feel joy? There was someone here today who talked about that in her, for her, because of her background, her religious background, it's considered to be, she had this wonderful Catholic word for it, concupiscence, is that the word? Concupiscence, someone knows, someone's Catholic here?
Concupiscence.
Concupiscence? She described it as meaning you can't go outside and enjoy the sun, because you went outside and enjoyed the warmth of the sun. That was a kind of a sin. So I don't know if that's true, but in Catholicism, but that's her understanding, what she picked up. So some people they've learned they've received feeling joy is not, you know, based on some authority, joy is not an appropriate thing to feel. So it isn't just simply authority of our teachers or our teachings, but it's also to really question deeply. Why we believe what we believe? On what authority do we believe the deepest things we believe about ourselves and then suffer because of it? So the Buddha went on and said, well, he didn't just simply say what you shouldn't believe, what authority you shouldn't just take blindly. Then he went on to offer the Kalamas this teaching. When you know for yourselves, and that's the key thing, when you know for yourselves, and that gets a lot of people's attention because most of us in the Western Buddhism want to have a practice where we can know for ourselves. We don't want to trust anything but what we can know for ourselves. But then the question is, and I ask you again, what can you reliably know for yourselves? So you have to help here with this talk.
I think it's intuition when you said that, but then you're saying not to follow your intuition, so it's confusing.
I have had intuitive hits that have been wrong. I have actually made mistakes based on my intuition. And then you can argue, well, that wasn't your true intuition. If you're really in touch with yourself, you'd really know. Well, how do I know then? I thought.
Kind of experimenting in an open way and kind of trying it on yourself.
Oh, so experimenting in an open way. So experimenting, so trial and error. That's pretty good, okay. What? That would be inference? Maybe. But if I like to eat a lot, and I overeat, and I get sick, I've learned something. So okay, I think maybe I've learned something here about eating. What happens to me? I get really tired after lunch if I eat a big lunch. So maybe I've learned something. I know that for myself now. Do I really know it? I only experimented one time. Let me do it again. Well, I only did it twice. I won't really, you know. At some point, you have to come to the conclusion. This is pretty reasonable. What else can we know for ourselves? What are some of the things that you think you can really know for yourself?
How you feel.
How you feel. That's good. What else?
You could in fact be mistaken about anything.
Sorry?
You could be mistaken about anything. I'm not sure that there's a process of penetrating discernment that can develop over time. And again, it might not. I mean, some of us may go to our graves totally ignorant, totally deluded, you know, deluded. And some not. And For myself, I really don't know.
What you can know.
What I can know. Yeah. Whether what I know is delusion or not.
So then there's no spiritual, there's no path for you then, a practice.
Well, for some reason, this is a path and I can't say why. I could be pursuing a particular, you know, got into the wrong movie.
So you just stumbled onto this, and because of your lack of imagination, this is where you're staying. Grace, you just met, yeah. So what I'd like to challenge you with, Marty, is that unless there's something you can know, there's no path, there's no practice for you, and you're wasting your time. So the question is, what can you know? What can you reliably know? Yes. Great. So very, very basic, organic kind of knowing. This is I'm alive. That's
question.
Please.
When Buddha said you can know yourself, was he speaking to an individual person?
He was talking to a group of people who came and talked to him. And he was just talking, he wasn't talking philosophically, you know, about the true self or something. He was just kind of talking generally, you guys. You know, when you guys can know for you, you know. Does that make sense? So I hadn't finished a sentence, but he said, when you know for yourselves that, and then I stopped and said, what is it you can know for yourselves? Some people will say, I can know my true self. I really know who I am. What some people have a lot of confidence in. They say, this is what I know. Some people will say, I really know about God or some divine, I can really know that for myself. This is what I know. There's a lot of things people make claims about that they can really know for themselves. And those, I think, you know, I think we should always study why we know something. On what basis do we know it? And what authority we know it? I think it's very, very liberating to do that. So this is what the Buddha had to say. When you know for yourselves that these qualities are unskillful, these qualities, these states of mind, these activities of mind, of heart, are blameworthy, that these qualities are criticized by the wise, these qualities, these states, when undertaken and carried out, lead to harm and to suffering, then you should abandon them. And then he went on to say, a little bit later, when you know for yourself these qualities are skillful, these qualities are blameless, these qualities are praised by the wise, these qualities, when undertaken and carried out, lead to welfare and to happiness, then you should enter and remain in them. And the operating thing for me here, the kind of, is when you know for yourself that this leads to harm and to suffering, and when you know for yourself that this leads to welfare and to happiness. The premise of the Buddha is that you can know for yourself the experience of suffering, and you can know for yourself that which creates that suffering and that which leads to happiness. You can experience happiness, you can experience peace, you can experience suffering, and you can really know that for yourself. And there might be other things you could know, but this is what the Buddha was concerned about in the practice he was offering. The Buddha once went in the forest with some of his students, and he picked up a bunch of leaves, and he said, "What do you think is?" I said, "What do you think is greater, the amount of leaves in my hand, or the number of leaves in the forest?" And the student said, you know, gee, you know, Buddha, it's pretty obvious. There's a lot more leaves in the forest than there are in your hand. And And then he said, in the same way, what I know, what I teach you versus what I know is like the leaves in my hand versus the leaves in the forest. Meaning he knows a lot more than what he's teaching. And I think the reason for that is he's teaching, the Buddha taught something very particular and very simple, and in a sense very narrow. So narrow that maybe some people who are interested in spirituality will find it too narrow for them. But what the Buddha was teaching, and what he said over and over again, he said, what I teach is one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. And the practice that he was teaching was based on what you can really experience and know for yourself without any doubt. And what we can really know for ourselves is that we suffer, and it's possible not to suffer. We cannot suffer. We cannot add suffering to our life. We can know our conflict. We can know that when we're in conflict, and we can end the conflict. And it's very simple. So one of the things we study in mindfulness practice is our suffering. We get interested in it. Not to be morbid, not to get depressed necessarily, but so we can become happier and become free of it. Because if we don't understand how we suffer, it's very hard realistically to become free of those forces of suffering, those forces of conflict within us, the forces of compulsion and attachment that exist. Another way of talking about all this is, which the monk Tanisaro, analogy he told me recently, is if you're a nature photographer and you want to go to the plains, of Africa, Kenya, where they have all these games and all these wild animals, and you want to get a photograph of all the different animals that exist there, you'd spend a lot of time, a lot of maybe wasted time, if you went driving around looking for all the animals and kind of finding each of them, take a picture of each of them. It takes too much work. Rather, what you do is you go to the waterhole and you set up your camera at the waterhole and you wait for the animals to come to you. And you can just kind of take it easy, just relax, wait. They come and you take a picture of them. So all the animals have to come to the waterhole eventually. It's kind of like that with our practice. Is we sit in the present moment and we pay attention to what comes to us in the present moment, but in particular we pay attention to our discomfort, our places we're uncomfortable, places we suffer, places where we feel tight or stressed, because whatever we need to learn about freedom can be discovered through going into that and discovering the forces of compulsive attachment and clinging and resistance and fear that exist there. So the Buddha's path, maybe it's not a spiritual path, but the Buddha's path is a very narrow path, focusing on a very narrow issue of our life, that maybe is not even going to tell us the meaning of life. It's not necessarily going to tell us a lot of things we can learn about life. It's not necessarily going to tell us about great spiritual truths about gods and goddesses and spiritual beings or whatever. But it is going to teach us how to live a life that's not in conflict, that's not going to suffer, that's going to be at peace, if I still can allow to use that word. And that is a phenomenal thing, not to be in conflict, not to be in resistance or in fear with life as it is. It's such a phenomenal thing to experience that, that the English word grace probably characterizes it the best. It's a state of being in grace, but we can't say it in Buddhism because usually grace means something we receive from, whatever. It's just a way of being. So in this practice, we study our suffering. We're interested in it. And what we try to do is to find a way to accept life as it is, accept ourselves as it is, rather than be in conflict with what is. And there's a world of difference between being in conflict with what is versus being accepting what is. And acceptance in Buddhist terminology is not approving something. It's neither approving nor rejecting. It's, in a sense, allowing things to be there without us having a compulsive relationship to it. And compulsive relationship is compulsive desire or compulsive aversion, or compulsive fear. Life presents ourselves, we sit at the waterhole of life, and all the different animals of life come to us. It's phenomenal what will come to us as we go through our life. Tremendous tragedy, tremendous challenges, tremendous illnesses can occur, tremendous loss, tremendous joys and delights can happen. These things just happen in our life. A lot of stuff happens as we go through life. Buddhist practice is not a protection from any of that. If you're mindful, you're going to be less accident prone. So that's nice. But, you know, so maybe you have a little bit less accidents as other people would have overall, maybe. But Buddhist practice doesn't protect you from all the things that can happen in human life. What Buddhist practice protects you from is how we ourselves contribute to our suffering. How we ourselves react and respond is where our suffering gets created. The suffering that we add to the situation, the optional suffering in any given event. So if we find ourselves in some tragedy, we find ourselves in a hospital, and our life is turned upside down from one day to the next because of the accident, there's a lot of reactions we might have to that. There's reactions of anger, of resistance. There's reactions of denial. There's a person might go into fantasy for 10 days because they don't want to deal with it. Just fantasize about something else. There can be self-pity. There's all these things we add to it. And the question we ask in the practice is our reaction response to the event that's happened, is it required? Does the event itself require that kind of response? One of the maybe a simple way of learning this is this lesson, which is around physical pain, discomfort, when we sit in meditation. Most of us will feel some discomfort in our body as we sit and meditate, unless we're constantly changing our posture to avoid it. But if you sit still, sooner or later you'll come to some kind of discomfort. One of the great lessons to be had with physical discomfort is to see the difference between physical discomfort and our relationship to the discomfort. We feel pain in the knee, and then we feel anger towards it, or we feel aversion towards it, or we feel self-pity because we have it, or we judge ourselves, you know. This other person sitting next to me, she hasn't moved in 3 days. You know, she's just sitting there with tremendous joy and bliss, and there's something spiritually wrong with me because I'm feeling physical pain. If only the pain wasn't there, then I could really kind of, you know, get it. You know, so we have all these evaluations and judgments and ideas about that we add on top of the simple experience of pain. It's possible to let pain be pain and not make anything of it. Not to react to it, not to judge it, not to hate it, not to... And pain, physical pain meditation, is one of the great places to see this. It's one of the great values of staying with your pain a little bit longer than maybe you normally would, is to start separating out your reactions to it, to the experience itself. You know, I was a little bit self-conscious in the beginning of the day about the soccer sounds, all the yelling, which was rather minor today compared to what it has been. And partly I say it because I'm concerned about some people being upset. And there are some people who hear the soccer sounds and they think it's lovely. And some people who hear the soccer sounds get all upset. How could they have chosen a meditation hall where there's all this noise? These bumbling fools who don't know about meditation, you know, they choose a noisy place. The response and the reaction is varied from person to person, but the response is optional. It's just sound. The sound doesn't require a judgment. The really terrible things happen to us in our life. And what we try to do in the meditation practice is try to understand, where is it that I add What is it that I do? What are the qualities, the unskillful qualities that I add to the soup that create more contraction, more tightness, more aversion, more suffering, and more hurt to the situation? And if we can know that, we can know for ourselves what creates pain, what creates suffering, what doesn't, then that we have the opportunity to, in small, maybe increments, to begin moving in the direction of not being in conflict with the situation, to allow things to be as they are, to allow ourselves to have a broken heart when our heart is broken, and not needing it to be any different, not to add judgment or aversion or interpretation or meaning on top of it, just to let our heart be broken. Or when we feel great joy and delight, to allow it to be there without being afraid that it's going to disappear, or be upset that it disappears, or try to plan every possible way to hold on to it, and the planning of it lose touch with it. Just to let joy be joy in a simple way, or let tragedy be tragedy. We can't necessarily trust everything that the mind conjures up. One of the great liberating realizations I had in my practice was to realize I didn't have to believe all my thoughts. How liberating. I don't know where I got the idea growing up that every thought was true. But when I was younger, I used to think that every possible thought I had to be true because I thought it. Why? So when I realized I didn't have to believe my thoughts, I was much more relaxed around life. But to trust myself, to trust ourselves, is a trust that we can know for ourselves how our reaction, what our reactions are, what our responses are, what's going on for us inside ourselves, what our feelings are, and then to know for ourselves, begin to know for ourselves, it's not necessarily we know it immediately, but as we begin to bring more mindfulness, to know for ourselves our different responses and reactions, to know the difference between reaction and response that's tight and conflicted with the situation, and a response which is open-handed, open-hearted to the situation. We find ourselves in all kinds of situations which are difficult. It's hard to be a human being, but can we simply let it be without being in conflict? Can we be, in a sense, be at peace with whatever's happening? That is a very narrow domain of Buddhist practice. The essential point of Buddhist practice. There's other things that are kind of auxiliary, that's kind of added as part of it, that are wonderful parts of it. But the essential point of Buddhism is that narrow. How does that sound to you? Is that too narrow? Is it too not enough? Do you want it to be more? And in the end, we learn not to be in conflict. What I find in myself and many of the people I talk with and living here in this part of the country is that there is a certain kind of discomfort with the teaching or the practice of letting go. But what people don't notice is many of us are constantly letting go of our ease, constantly letting go of our state of non-conflict, of our peace. We're constantly letting go of our well-being by our judgments, our evaluations, by our busyness, by wanting more and more things, by wanting this and that, by giving in unconsciously to our minor irritations and judgments and hurries, being in a hurry, our fear of what other people think of us. We're constantly giving something away by getting caught up compulsively with all of those things. We're experts at giving away, at giving up, letting go. But we let go of the wrong things. To take Buddhist practice seriously is to take seriously the possibility that it's possible to live a life that doesn't have any conflict in it. You don't have to believe it's possible. You don't have to take it as a, you know, absolute necessity. But to really take it seriously, it's possible to move in that direction. And to take it seriously, it takes seriously enough that that becomes a higher priority than having infinite number of recreational opportunities. Or having, you know, or having a high paid job, or have our boss's approval, or have, you know, someone else's approval, or to have enough, to have the right kind of car, or expensive car. There's all these ways in which other priorities gets us kind of acting compulsively and faster and doing things and doing things and doing things. And but to take Buddhist practice seriously is to make a very high priority the possibility of living a life which is not in conflict, and then studying how that can be done. Now, you don't have to do that. I don't care too much whether people take this very seriously. I'm just saying that someone today in their interviews felt that I'm kind of saying it wrong now. I think I'm stretching what was talked about, but that as Buddhist teachers, we don't talk enough about the options that are available to us as practitioners. We just kind of offer a practice, but we don't talk about all the options. So that's why I'm saying this. One of the options, if you're interested enough, if you're serious enough about it, is to find a life which is not in conflict. And that is a phenomenally beautiful thing to do. And it's one of the most beautiful gifts that you can give to your society around you, is to end up being a person who's not in conflict. So, I hope that was okay to talk this way. Maybe I was preaching too much. But I offer this talk as a challenge in many different fronts. Challenge you in your ideas about spirituality, your ideas about what you can really know for yourself, and your ideas about what you think Buddhist practice is and where the real work is of Buddhist practice. Any important questions before we end? Yes.
On the statement about the number of leaves and the fact that the Buddha is just offering this very narrow path, do you think he was saying that it's not necessary to have the wider view with all the leaves in the forest, or was he saying that if you follow this narrow path, you'll get all the other stuff too?
I don't know that answer. But I suspect that it's there's a lot of things in life that I'm never going to know. But I don't have to know them in order to be at peace. And actually, in terms of what's often called spiritual, in the Buddhist time, they believed in, or they knew, or I don't know what, deities. All these deities that exist up in the heavenly realms. There were some people who became liberated, and through the particular kind of practice they had, could know about those realms. And there were other people who became liberated who never knew about those realms. Liberation was not dependent upon knowing about those realms or not. So it's more interesting to become liberated, isn't it? Some people are more interested in knowing all kinds of wonderful things. But why are we more interested in knowing those things? That's the interesting question. Why are we interested? For example, the question of some people have said to be spiritual is to be interested in the meaning of life. I propose to you, and this is my opinion, that Buddhism doesn't offer anyone the meaning of life. Buddhism, rather than offering the meaning of life, what Buddhism offers is a challenge to you to understand why are you interested in the meaning of life? What's the motivation for it? Because some people are anxiously concerned about the meaning of life. But if you go back and turn the mirror back, and why is it you want to know the meaning of life? And you deal with that anxiety, and you no longer have the anxiety, and you're at peace, then what happens to the need to know about the meaning? It's fine to search for meaning. It's fine to maybe even find it. But we have to search for meaning at the expense of being at the expense of losing our peace. And the Buddha, I believe, would say, no. You don't have to, and this is what this teaching is of the Buddha. You don't have to lose your peace in the search for meaning. And perhaps more important than finding the meaning of life is finding your peace. Maybe. That's for you to decide. Yes, Lee.
On the way over here, I had some anger and aversion. When I got here, I felt the sweetness. The space here was really beautiful. And I started to open up to that. And so then I thought, well, the suffering that I experienced on the way over here, maybe if I conjured that now, the space and the good attention that I have here, then I can, you know, discover it or search, you know. Is that a technique that people use to bring, you know, if you experience some suffering in the past or even, you know, just in the recent past, and you feel a really good space now, you know, because when you're in it, it's hard to have that mindfulness to
right.
Have that
yeah, certainly. I myself, generally don't, generalization, generally don't recommend that kind of way of practicing, but rather keep cultivating mindfulness in the present moment and then bring that mindfulness with you into life. And then when those things come up, you're ready to be pay attention in the moment. So don't look for trouble. I mean, don't create trouble when it's not there. But to cultivate your mindfulness, strengthen it so that when trouble comes, you're ready to study it when it does come. But occasionally, I think it can be very useful to do what you did. If it's something that's really troubling you and it's a recurrent theme and happening a lot, anger keeps coming up, and in your normal life is just your mind is a little bit too busy to really pay attention to it, it can be very valuable to use a place of great calm and stability and then to kind of bring it up and to look at it then and see it in a new way. So it can be very useful. It has its place. Yes, Nancy.
Last week when you taught in the Kama Sutta, so I've been kind of practicing with this, and we use the word suffering, and in some ways that's, we're doing ourselves a disservice in using that translation, because it sounds like it's something big.
Uh-huh.
And most of your examples, you talked about tragedies.
Right.
And I found it more useful this week to be looking at just the small things, just the little ways in which, you know, one morning I woke up before the alarm, and later thinking I could go back to sleep, but then the alarm would pull me out of being asleep, and no, back and forth. And I said, wait a minute, suffering, created suffering right here, fretting about the alarm clock. So it's useful to look at the little things and not something that all we're talking about.
Yes, I think so. It's very important what you said. Some of us are very eager to practice with the big things, and are completely oblivious to paying any attention to the small discomforts and small sufferings. And we're interested in wherever it happens. And actually, it might, for some of us, it actually might be more important and more useful to pay careful attention to the small things, because you have much more options there. And rather than the big things, which are so overwhelming, pay attention to the small ways in daily life in which you kind of tighten and contract and get fearful or whatever. And then begin to soften those up. And then if that becomes, actually become the strength that you have, the strength of not having all these small kind of irritations. You know, for example, don't get irritated next time you go on 101, Highway 101. Make that a practice. If you can discover how not to get upset or how not to suffer driving on Highway 101, which is a relatively small thing, that, I think, actually is very significant. And that'll serve you really well in bigger issues. I think it's very well what you said, very important. Many of us are too tolerant of our small sufferings. We don't pay attention to it. And doing all this, you know, what I'm saying in a sense is, another way of talking about all this is this practice is a practice of tremendous generosity, tremendous allowing, of allowing ourselves to be as we are. And the spirit of this practice, the spirit is it really a spirit of tremendous, compassionate, generous, allowing ourselves our full who we are and accepting ourselves and forgiving ourselves for who we are as we are. And to do that really thoroughly is to begin to soften all the places which we're in conflict with ourselves. Because conflict is non-acceptance. So it's really beautiful. I love this practice, and I loved coming here today. And just the way Lee felt, kind of sweetness coming in here. I feel, generally, when I'm sitting with all of you and sitting here, I feel that this room and this space that we create can hold anything. Anything that we are, anything that we bring, can be held in it. I think it's a little bit rare in our society to come into a space, into a place where anything that we bring is okay. Any part, any way we are is okay. And we can just sit with it mindfully. So, but things have to end too. And we've gone almost 20 minutes over. In this timeless world, we've gone 20 minutes over. There's this wonderful thing that people sometimes, when the practice gets, when people really don't suffer anymore, this kind of, when people don't add clinging or compulsion, this grace that I talked about is sometimes described in the Buddhist tradition as an experience of the timeless, timeless present. And the paradox is that a person can say, at 18 minutes after 5 on Saturday afternoon, I experienced the timeless. So may you all be at peace, be without conflict. May whatever benefit we've had from this day of practice together be for our own experience of non-conflict, and so that other people that we encounter and other people in the world can also discover the joy of not being conflicted. May all beings be without conflict. Thank you.